I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We have a real treat, and the treat of this man we're talking to right now is someone who's coming to Baltimore. We'll talk about that. He's one of the great jazz musicians, artists, geniuses, intelligentsia of our time, born in that magic year when several people were born who made jazz what it is in America today. I'm talking about Jimmy Heath, and he has a book out called I Walk with Giants, the autobiography of Jimmy Heath. And Jimmy Heath, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. It's my pleasure to be with you.
I have to ask this one question first. You played in Baltimore as a younger man, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I played there lots of times, including many times with the Left Bank Jazz Society.
That's right.
But even before they started, I played there.
You played on the Avenue, on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yes, I did. That was with the Left Bank Jazz Society.
And it was, it was amazing because back in the day, I mean, Pennsylvania Avenue was, it was a piece of jazz history. And kind of black communities across the nation had their Pennsylvania Avenues.
Mm-hmm.
And people played them all across the country.
Right. I played there with Miles Davis on Pennsylvania Avenue.
It's amazing. When you wrote your book, the autobiography, I Walk with the Giants, I mean, you meant that. You did walk with the Giants.
Yes, I did. I was very fortunate to be around all of the people basically from the bebop generation, but some from the early swing generation also.
So I, when you think about this trajectory of yours and of the world of jazz and where it's come to now, and what it's meant to America, this really is, as many people have said, comes almost trite, but I think it's not said talked about enough. For you to talk to us a bit about how jazz really is our classical music.
Well, you know, of all the styles and forms of music that we have coming out of America, country, blues, and gospel, and all of those, it's kind of a combination. Of jazz is kind of a combination of all those genres, including an adaptation of some of the harmonies from Europe. But it's African influence, and along with the European influence, started here. And that's why we are treated so royally, usually around the world, sometimes more than at home.
In your growing into jazz, I'm really curious for our listeners to hear, especially our younger listeners, but your sojourn was into the world of jazz as a young man. I mean, you first played in the International Jazz Festival in '48, and you were just 21 years old then. But tell us about the lead up to that for you.
Well, you know, I started playing in high school, and right after high school, I went into a dance band out of Philadelphia, and then another one from Philly, and then I went to Omaha, Nebraska in Midwest, where there was a dance band who was did a lot of national traveling. And from that band, I later went with Dizzy Gillespie's band and Howard McGhee band and some of the well-known luminaries from the bebop generation.
Well, I wonder when you look at this incredible body of work you've created. I mean, I don't know if I can even remember the number of albums, but it's in three figures, the number of albums you've created over the years with your brothers and with everybody else that you can name. You name a jazz musician, giant, great. You are one of the greats that played with them. And it seems, though, that in some ways, jazz has been not forgotten, but it's losing its place. It's losing its hold on the imagination of young people. Do you think that's true, or do you think that's just...
Well, you know, every generation has their own music that they like. And commercial music that it requires less musical knowledge. It's always been important to people who haven't studied music, or, you know, I think it's a problem is that the educational system in this country doesn't foster jazz music like they do in other countries. They, you know, I was telling someone the other day, when you go to the airport in Paris, you may hear Stravinsky, you may hear Charlie Parker, you may hear B.B. King, you may hear Elvis Presley. They play everything. And people are used to having all these different styles and genres exposed to them, and they can accept each one in its place. Here we seem to go to one style, and that's where you're number one. You're number one. If you're not number one, what's wrong with being number 10?
Amen. It's true, though. I mean, but when you studied music as a kid, how did you start? Did you start with your family, in church, in school? Where did you begin your musical sojourn as a student?
Well, I took private lessons on the saxophone, but I had started in high school, as I mentioned before. So then my family had a lot of the swing and jazz music in the house. And, you know, this is something that people learn, you know, it's possible to learn how to play in the university of the streets or in clubs and everything. Jazz music, it comes about in a lot of different ways. And, you know, I did study later on. I was already playing when I wanted to be better. Then I started studying composing and arranging and other things that I wanted to add to my arsenal.
And you said something earlier about the idea of young people not understanding the complexities of music, especially in today's music. And that is, I mean, that is partially what's happening in our school systems, where music has short shrift. Your kids are not really studying music in a serious way like they study math or something else.
Yeah.
And we kind of lack a balance that way.
That is true. You know, there was a program, a government program, that was sponsored and people at Jazzmobile, Dr. Billy Taylor, and we had money to play in the school system. And this was back, in the 70s. And when we would do that, we'd go in these schools and play, and some of the kids say, "Wow, we never had jazz in school. They always send in string quartets in here and Western classical music, which they support very wholeheartedly, and they don't support the African-American classical music or jazz music, as we call it, which has all kinds of ethnic groups performing it. You know, so I don't know. You know, Max Roach said something I love to repeat. And he says, if you don't like jazz, you don't like democracy.
Whoa, I love that.
Democratic music, when you have one person controlling the whole thing, it's not like that with jazz. Everybody in the group improvises. And you hear the bass player play some, and the piano player some, the drummer playing constantly, and your horn players come in and different. But it's, you know, it's not like a symphony orchestra where one person controls. It's a democratic music. Everybody gets to show and speak their language of jazz the way they do.
You know, that quote, I really have to, I mean, I really have to wrestle with that quote, and I have to think about, I think I could do an entire hour's conversation on that quote alone.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with him. I mean, because even when I'm conducting a big band, I stand on the side and let everybody play some.
You do.
You know, you start them off and you cut them off at the end. But otherwise, everybody gets to play. That's the way democracy is supposed to be. that everybody should be able to speak in their way that they speak, in a fashion. In a jazz world, it's improvisation. Tell your story.
But you know,
and the next person has an opportunity to tell theirs. They're not all backing up one person.
It's that theme itself kind of goes to the heart of democracy and improvisation, the American character, the American soul, to the soul of the Black community, and what it offered and gave to America. It's all wrapped up in that one little idea. That's pretty explosive.
Well, you know, I agree that it's improvisational music. And, you know, when you see the hip-hop or whatever today's music is, they have a little bit of that. They have a little bit where they have certain people in the group that would play. So that is different. The problem with that is I don't agree with any music that puts down women. My mother's a woman. Yours is.
Amen.
That's how right. Can you put them down? You know, so it's certain things in that music that, to me, is just not unnatural for me to criticize and down my partner. I've been married 50 years. I love my woman.
50 years. Congratulations.
Yep.
Well, that's because we've, you know, in the same way, I mean, there's a lot of beautiful creativity, I think, in hip hop, in the world of hip hop.
Yeah, it's creativity in it.
But what
the thing is, Mark, is that some of the schools in the neighborhoods that I'm talking about, in the ghetto or whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
That have no more instruments in the schools.
Right.
So the African-American young people have made up a style of music with whatever they have. We did that in our time. People played on a washboard
mm-hmm.
or whatever. It's a creative force, but there's a lack of exposure of the thing called jazz, that music, in the schools when they're young people so that they have some of that too in their background. And then they wouldn't think it's so strange and out and different.
Well, you know, when you describe it the way you've just described it, it's like when you think of the entire deconstruction of American society and what's happened in the last 40 years since the end of segregation and what's kind of also exploded and imploded at the same time.
Right.
Part of that's what you're describing, and that's what's happened to our children.
Right.
They've lost that sense of balance, that creative artistic, not just the ability to do it, but it's the discipline that learning an instrument gives you.
Well, I think if they started at a young age, you know, there's still thousands of young people going to the music schools to learn how to play. So
mm-hmm.
jazz is not dead. They've been saying jazz is dead since I was a kid, and I'm 84. Jazz is not dead as long as there are some people. But I'm talking about being accepted by the masses. It would have to be in the schools that early in their lives.
One of the things that is an interesting consequence of just life and existence, and I didn't realize it until today as I was reading some things in your book, which unfortunately I just got, so I couldn't finish it before we started the conversation. I wish I had. But that you and Miles Davis and John Coltrane were all born in the same year.
Right. And Ray Brown and Tony Bennett and Lou Donaldson and Randy Weston and Mal Waldron.
Wow.
A lot of us was born that 1926.
That's pretty amazing. What do you think it was about your generation and that era?
Oh, I don't know. Because I know, you know, I'm a statistician and I know that 1920 23 was a whole lot of great guys, too.
No, that's cool. No, what I meant,
every year.
I meant your generation as a whole. I'm talking about the men and women who were born in the late teens through the 20s who created this world of jazz that we all love now. What was it about your time that allowed jazz to evolve and create the way it and be created?
Well, I think we were beginning to feel, as Americans, the freedom that was heretofore not given to us. You see what I mean? That was after World War II, and we had some freedoms. And we began to express ourselves a little more in that fashion. You know, I mean, there were, you know, I went to hear Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey and all those bands in Philadelphia at the Earl Theater. I heard all of the bands. The big band was in vogue at the time. And that is the essence of, I wouldn't say the essence, it is the largest ensemble we have in jazz is the big band or stage band. That's like the European Symphony Orchestra.
Right.
We got more colors and textures in the big band than we have in any other type group. If you take Duke Ellington, they had, you know, he had sextets, the way he played Mood Indigo. You have a clarinet, trumpet, and trombone. And he may have a quintet. Out of a big band, you get all kinds of different colors.
There's several things you just said, Jimmy Heath, in the course of this brief time we've been talking that I've never thought about. I think many people have not, just in terms of the historical intellectual power of jazz, where it comes from and what it says to us as Americans. I think that might have been missing from, what's his name's, History of Jazz he put on PBS, because you weren't in that, were you?
Yeah, well, he was supposed to interview me, but I'm glad he didn't, because he had only the category of the beboppers who happened to be victims and ended up with narcotic addiction.
Right.
And he put all of them in the same group.
Right.
Not their genius as musicians, but it was, you know, it was a little degrading, as if bankers and people of other genres don't use narcotics and alcohol and whatever.
Amen to that. That is true.
So, you know, that's a part of the history where some of us slipped and had a hard time, and some of them got out of it, and like myself, or Stan Getz, and a few of us made a mistake in life, and as all human beings do, and we got out of it.
And I think that's another important piece to talk about. And I wish we had more time to do all of this. I have to ask this one question, though. A brother here, Marcellus Shepard, known as the Bass Man, is one of our premier jazz and music announcers here at WEAA in Baltimore, Morgan State University.
Yeah.
He asked me before, he said, when he realized I was going to talk to you, he wanted to know what your thoughts were about the Marcellus family becoming NEA Jazz Masters and the controversy around that, also about the greatness of the great Ellis Marcellus. I'm talking about the dad.
Well, I agree that Ellis, Branford, and Winton should get it.
Right.
I don't agree with Delfeo and Jason. I know all of them. But I would say, like the Chinin that writes for the Times here, like he said, what happened to Albert Tootie Heath not getting a Jazz Master? Percy
right.
got it, and I got it.
Right.
And he, my brother Tootie, has played with everybody from Ben Webster, Don Byas, Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, Benny Golson, Dexter Gordon. He's in what you call him now, playing a tribute to Dexter. He's in Copenhagen.
Really?
He just called me this morning.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, you know, I think it's a lot of people should have gotten it way before those two.
Well, a lot of folks think it also has to do with the NEA's ties to Lincoln Center and all the rest. And
I don't know about that. The NEA has done great things. They have tried, and they changed a lot when the last person who was in charge, a poet from Stanford,
mm-hmm.
when he was in charge. He got more visibility for the NEA, and, you know, but the money is still ludicrous when you're talking about life achievement.
Well, and I do agree. I mean, Ellis Marsalis, the father, I mean, is an amazing. He's like you in the way that they both are some of the great jazz, not just jazz, but American intellectuals of our history and our social history of America. I mean, that was that you both have that inside of you.
Well, Ellis taught a lot of guys who are out here who are great now performers. So Ellis is definitely deserving, and Winton is too, and Branford. I don't have a problem with that. And I don't bite my tongue. I'll tell Jason and Delphio. I know both of them. I don't think, you should have gotten it before a lot of other people I know did, because everybody else seems to have to wait a certain age.
Right, right, right.
And a certain amount of historical achievement.
I agree. You have to have that, as people say, that bottom to you before you should get it, I think.
Yeah.
So tell me, where are you playing next? What's your next gigs coming up?
I'm playing at Flushing Town Hall this Friday with the Jazz Masters Group, and that's Curtis Fuller and Barry Harris and Jim Hall and my brother Trudy on drums and David Wong, a young man, on bass. It is called the NEA Jazz Masters Concert because four out of six are jazz masters, you know, and Tootie should be included, but he hasn't been so far. But Dana Joya was the man who was in charge at NEA. I was trying to think of before. He's the one that gave us more visibility and raised the money just a little bit.
This has been a huge honor, Jimmy Heath, and I look forward to meeting you when you come to Baltimore.
Okay.
At the Enoch Pratt Free Library. I'm really dying to shake your hand. It'll be an honor to meet you.
Yeah, I'd like to meet you too, Mark Steiner, right?
That's it. Thank you so much, Jimmy Heath.
Bye-bye.
See you at Enoch Pratt. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. We'll be right back. Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538.